STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my dear friends. So glad to talk with you today on Stand to Reason. That's our show. And I am Greg Kokel, your host, with you now this 26th year. Actually, it's a little misleading. 26th year in radio. I think we didn't start calling this show Stand to Reason until about 4 or 5 years into the enterprise. But anyway, I've been in this saddle for a while and always looking forward to taking your calls and your comments. Interaction about the most important issues of life, my goal to stand to reason for classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Somebody asked me the other day, what does that mean, classical Christianity? And it is meant to distinguish broad Christianity that is identified by the creedal statements and the standard doctrines of Christianity from the outset, from the earliest stages of official creedology, Apostles' Creed on, from all of the Christian-ish lookalikes, and they're not really lookalikes because they depart from these in some significant way, but have a lot of similar language. But so I'm just the basic what Francis Schaeffer called mere Christian. Defending mere Christianity, though I'd have to say, to be a little bit more precise, especially in the Protestant tradition, because I do think there are some differences between Protestants and Rome that go back to the 16th century, and those main things, too, in my view, justification and authority, haven't changed a bit. They still stand. And these things are significant. But anyway, not to get too parochial here, it's basically classical Christianity that I'm defending. And I think it can stand to reason in the public square. And that's why we do this show now for so many years. My number, 855-243-9975. And if you're listening live, which is very few of you, you can call in and get in the queue. Most of you are listening either by tape delay on a Sunday in our markets or through podcast, and glad to have you all on board, even if by delay. My live show is on Tuesday nights from 4 until 7. Tuesday nights 4 until 7 Los Angeles time. That's the time to call, as people are doing at the moment. And by the way, we had some excitement in Conejo Oaks last week. That would be my subdivision there in Thousand Oaks, just inside of Ventura County in Southern California here. And you might have heard about it, because just after that, I was all the way on the other side of the country, Boca Raton, Florida, and there were folks there that were aware of these strange incidents in Thousand Oaks, California last week. We had a cobra on the loose. Can you imagine that? It was loose in our neighborhood. Now, we have rattlesnakes in our neighborhood. Well, they're not mostly in everybody's yards unless you're close to the edge of the chaparral. And there are a lot of homes that are like that. We're not like that. But I've seen rattlesnakes walking around. I should back it up. I've seen rattlesnakes while I was walking around. The rattlesnakes weren't walking around. That doesn't happen anymore. But I've seen them, so we got snakes. But this was a cobra. And, in fact, it was a white cobra, an albino, which is good because they're easy to see. Now, I learned about this partly because, well, first I think I got an email from my son, and he works at the ER. I don't know how he found out about it. And then I started getting emails from all over, people in Southern California who had heard about the cobra. Now, how did they find out that the cobra was on the loose? It was not because the person who owned the cobra found it missing and he let everybody else know, because he wasn't supposed to own the cobra. Turns out owning venomous snakes is illegal in California or L.A. and Ventura counties, at least. I think L.A. County, you can't own any snake, which to me is a little bit much. But in any event, certainly a cobra, unless you have a special license like you're a zoo or something like that. But there's a guy in the neighborhood, and I'm talking, what, 5 blocks from my house, who apparently has been cited before for violation of exotic animal ownership laws. In any event, they hadn't really fingered the guy yet, but they were pretty sure who it was. But they did know that there was a snake on the loose. And how did they know that? Because at least the initial story was a dog had gotten bit, and the owner was there. Well, we do a lot of walking in our neighborhood. My wife and I and our girls, we went out for a walk last night after dinner. It's a very nice neighborhood. It's an old neighborhood, so lots of big trees and everything. And people walk and walk their dogs, and they walk their horses or trot their horses. And it's a horse area, you know, so it's nice like that. And this guy must have been walking his dog, and the dog cornered the snake and, bap, got nipped. Now, I've since heard that the dog didn't get bit, but the dog got hurt trying to jump away from the snake. I don't know. And maybe the owner thought he was bit. So there's a little confusion about that. I just heard that today. But in any event, there's a snake on the loose. Now, the directions for the families in the area were simple. Keep your pets in and keep your doors closed. A little bit hot lately in Southern California, at least in our area. So we like to have the windows and doors open. But my daughters were concerned with our cat. Now, we have a cat. Not little anymore. Never was. We got Sophie, which I guess is short for Sophia, which means wisdom. Like, I don't know if that's significant or not, but like philosophy, lover of wisdom. So maybe there's a little irony in the fact that we have a cat named Sophie. But the girls were very concerned about Sophie. They're very close to Sophie. I'm not so attached, let's just put it that way. And I said, I don't care about Sophie. I care about you. We were driving in the car on our way to school. I take him to school, then I pick him up afterwards. We carpool. So I pick him up afterwards at the carpool place. We drive out, and I pick him up at the carpool on the way back, short one in the afternoon. But on the way out, I said, and I'm looking to make a point here, friends, and you know part of what I try to do, and I don't know that I'm particularly clever at being a good Christian dad, but, you know, you do the best you can and take the opportunities that come your way is the way I look at it, and try to make some usefulness out of this story, snakes are loose. And I told him, I don't care so much about the cat compared to you, because a cat's an animal, and you're my daughters, you're human beings, humans are special. And so I tried to use the opportunity to explain a little bit about that. Of course, they weren't getting it, because all they could think of is that beloved cat being bit by this snake. So I had to drive the point home a little bit more intentionally. Look, girls, all right, I care about Sophie, but compared to you, no contest. Humans are more valuable than animals, and so much more valuable that you might as well say you don't even care at all about the animal when compared to how much you care about the human being. And I did point out that some people, unfortunately, care more for an animal that they know than for a human being that they don't know. And I didn't want my girls to be confused on this point. I can see how one's emotional attachment can be greater, how subjectively, affectively, you might personally care more for the pet you know than the human you don't know, but we ought not act that way, because objectively the humans are infinitely more valuable. There's no comparison. That was the point. Then I got to thinking, why was that snake still out on the loose? They had a sighting. In fact, they didn't have just a sighting. They had a photograph of a white, that is, albino cobra up against a brick retaining wall, sticking its head up with its hood out, which means it's mad. Cobras don't always have that hood. They can slither around if they're not agitated. They look like any other snake. You get them agitated, you corner them, they'll pop that head up and flare the hood. I lived in Thailand. I saw lots of them. I actually saw them in the zoo. But they were around. I just never saw any in my backyard while I lived there. But they were. I saw green pit vipers, and they're nasty things. They were hanging in the backyard. But anyway, they had a picture of this thing. Who took the picture? Well, the guy with the dog took the picture, of course, and that's the picture he gave to the news service. And so when we heard about the snake, there's a picture of the snake right there. So here's my question, and maybe it's a question that you've already asked. How is it that a week ago yesterday, a dog allegedly gets bit? We'll just assume that he was bit. The dog survived, by the way, so don't worry. And it might be because he didn't get bit at all, but in any event, allegedly, the dog got bit on Monday, and on Thursday, the snake was still at large. But on Monday, somebody took a picture of the snake, and it's a white snake. It virtually glows in the dark. So how is it the snake was still at large for 4 days after it was photographed? Now, you tell me. I'll tell you what I think happened, and I didn't go down and check this all out. I'm just thinking about it. But my suspicion is that the guy who had the dog snapped the picture, grabbed his dog, and ran off to the vet to save his dog and left the snake on the loose. Now, I'm not saying he should have tried to grab the snake, but that snake was scared. It was cornered against a wall. He took a picture of it. He could have phoned 911 and stood there for 15 minutes while the good guys came and looped that snake and took it away. But he didn't do that, did he? He left the scene, and that snake was on the loose until Thursday. Now, I had this conversation with my girls in the morning, and I'll tell you, we prayed as a family that morning. We're five blocks away. There's a lot of yards between us and that snake. Chances are it wasn't going to travel much. It's going to hole up somewhere and just wait it out. It's scared, and that's what ended up happening. So I didn't think we were really at risk. But it's better safe than sorry, right? Not only when we prayed, did I put it before the Lord to ask for his help to for us and anyone else, but also Dad is praying for the safety of his children before his children. So that's got a value also. And then we got in the car and we talked, had that conversation. They went to school, and then I picked them up. And I said, let's drive by the snake place because we know where it was at. We had the address. Let's just drive by. Maybe we'll see it. Now, we were in the car. I wasn't going to poke around in the brush with my daughters or anything like that. But so we drove down the lane, Rancho Lane, I think it was called, the 300 block, and we asked. And there were some vans and some TV camera guys, and they were just setting up. Something was going on. So we pulled up, rolled down the window. Hey, what's up? They caught the snake. Wow, that's great. Where'd they catch it? Right over there. A guy pointed at the wrought iron fence, and he said it was just laying there by the fence. Now, that wasn't very far from where the snake was first sighted. Now, I know that they combed the area after the sighting and, you know, weren't able to find it. But I'm glad they finally got it, and that was the end of a kind of an interesting little adventure in our neighborhood, which it could have had a very different ending, couldn't it have? But why would it have had a different ending? It's because presumably, conceivably, someone valued their animal more than they valued their neighbors. Now, again, I could be mistaken on this, but I do know there was a photograph on it. I do know there was an alleged bitten dog, and I do know that that dog went to the vet. And I do know that the snake was still at large right after those events. So, look, this isn't rocket science, right? And there it is. The very lesson that I was trying to communicate to my daughters with regards to Sophie the cat, animals aren't as important as human beings. That principle apparently was violated by one of the main players in this enterprise. What's up with that? Anyhow, okay, so that's this last week's adventure. We'll see what happens next week, and we'll keep you posted. Let's go to break right now, and then I'll get to your calls after this. You're listening to Greg Kokol on Stand to Reason.
According to recent statistics, one out of every four college professors is a professing atheist or agnostic. The majority of professors view the Bible as an outdated book filled with myths. More than half of college professors have unfavorable feelings towards evangelical Christians. When your students head off to college, will they be ready for the people who are waiting for them? Let Stand to Reason help. We've designed a student conference to equip your youth. Join us for the Rethink Student Apologetic Conference in Southern California on September 26 and 27. For more information or to register, check out rethinkapologetics.com.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273. Or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
All right, friends, back at you here on Stand to Reason. The show that turns your mind on. And time to go to calls here. Let's see. How about Adam in Boston? Adam?
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Hey, you got to go park your car in the yard, huh?
That's right. Hey, first off, my nieces are attending the Rethink Conference. So
no kidding. Really,
yeah, my nieces are driving out from Idaho Falls to go see you.
Is that Idaho Falls, Idaho?
Idaho Falls, Idaho, yeah.
Oh, man. Amy, did you hear that? Idaho Falls, Idaho. Wow, that's fabulous. And we're just doing the numbers. The first year we had 300. Second year we had last year 600. We have, as of like a few days ago, we had 598 people already signed up and paid.
Wow.
That means we got 3 weeks to go, which means we could easily add another 200 or 300 people. This place is going to be hopping because it holds 1,100 stuff to the gills. So we're really thrilled at this response, and I'm really glad to know people from as far away as Idaho are coming to the event. But by the way, since you brought that up, let me just mention September 26th and 27th, Crossline Church in Orange County, California, Rethink Apologetics Youth Conference. Let's see, too late for early bird registration. Pre-conference reg, $39, and that's for all evening Friday and all day Saturday. At the door, it's going to cost you $10 more. But Brett Kunkel and Alan Schliemann and myself will be there representing Stand to Reason. We'll have other speakers, including Sean McDowell. So you can tell your nieces they're in for a treat, and they're going to really enjoy themselves in Southern California in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I've been really talking you guys up, so you better deliver.
Oh, wow. No pressure, huh?
No pressure.
All right. Okay, oh, yeah. What's on your mind today, Adam?
So your introduction was really apropos to the show, because you were talking about basic Christianity, classical Christianity.
Uh-huh.
And so my question is kind of along the same lines. And this is kind of an oversimplified version of it, just to kind of kick it off.
Okay.
My question is, how orthodox does one have to be saved? And I acknowledge that it's, like I said, it's kind of an oversimplified question to a big issue.
Yeah, I don't think it's oversimplified. I think you're asking a very basic question. What what are the essentials, or what are the, maybe here's a way to put it, the sine qua nons. Now, the word sine qua non, like S-I-N-E-Q-U-A-N-O-N, people might have seen this Latin phrase before. It means literally without which not. That is, a sine qua non is a quality or a requirement without which the thing you've been talking about is no longer the thing you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if you take away a sine qua non from something, it ceases to be that something. It is maybe something else similar, but it's not that something. It is a bare essential. It is a requirement. And it is a fabulous question to ask, what are the sine qua nons of Christianity? But I don't think it's that hard to answer. And so just think for me a moment. What things, if they were not true, would result in Christianity being falsified? Well, let's see. Our story starts in the beginning, God. Well, if Richard Dawkins is right and there is no God, well, then Christianity's false, right? So therefore, God, the existence of God, and here we're talking about a personal God, is a sine qua non of Christianity, without which not. So the existence of God is one of those, okay? I think a second thing has to do with the nature of man. Human beings are unique in creation in that they are, one, made in the image of God, and two, they are fallen. They are beautiful, yet they are broken. And they are beautiful because they bear God's image, but they are broken because of their own rebellion against their sovereign. So you have the fall of the unique creature, human beings, as being part of the sine qua non. If there was no fall, nothing further, nothing that follows from after Genesis chapter 3 makes any sense whatsoever. And therefore, this is why, incidentally, the toying with theistic evolution is so dangerous. I wrote a piece a year and a half ago called Drifting Towards Darwin. And in this piece, I was raising the question of how dangerous is it for confessing Christians to embrace something like theistic evolution. And part of the question was, and never mind the merits of Darwinism itself, that's a separate issue for now. I'm just going to set that aside. That is, whether or not Darwinism is believable on the merits. I think not, but that's different. I'm just asking the theological question. If the neo-Darwinian synthesis is true, what consequences does that have for orthodoxy? And it seems to me pretty clear that if that's the case, then there could not have been an Adam made in the image of God who fell from grace. And if you don't have that, then, like I said, nothing that follows makes any sense. So that strikes me as a second feature, having both of those qualities. Human beings, beautiful, but morally broken and culpable. They're in trouble. Okay, so that's the second piece. Okay, now what did God do by way of rescue plan to resolve the problem? Man's in trouble. He can't save himself. Well, God becomes a man himself in the person of Jesus. And this is an absolutely unique feature. It is not only a sine qua non, that without which, but it is also an absolutely unique feature of Christianity, that the God that exists, in order to save the man that exists, became a man himself. And that means that the man that God became is a God-man. And this is Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, so now you got three pieces to the puzzle: God, man, Jesus. Now, if you've been listening for very long, this is going to start to sound familiar.
Yep.
God, man, Jesus. Gee, there's two more, isn't there? Cross, resurrection. I mean, that's credo. This is the backbone of the Christian narrative that I talk about in the talk Credo and in the book that I'm slowly assembling by the same title. And the goal of this book is to help people to answer the question just that you're asking, Adam, and that is, what are the bare essentials? And I want people to see the bare essentials related to each other in a narrative form. So there's God, man, Jesus. Jesus is the God-man. Now, what does Jesus do? Well, he lives a morally perfect life, and then he makes a trade with the Father. And the trade happens on a cross, on a place locally called Golgotha, the place of the skull, but we know it as Calvary, the place of the cross. Okay, and so Jesus then becomes the substitute. He dies in our place. He gets our crime, so we get his goodness. That's the trade. Now, I don't see how you can get rid of that. I don't see how that can be somehow diminished or dismissed, and you still have Christianity. Jesus died for our sins, to put it colloquially. Anyway, I don't know how to say it, but I can spell it. In a colloquial fashion. All right. So we got God, man, Jesus, cross. And here I'm talking about cross, substitutionary atonement. And then we've got resurrection. And now this is actually double entendre at this point, because we have to have the resurrection of Jesus. Because if we have the resurrection of Jesus, we have nothing that secures, no confidence that secures not only the victory of the cross, but our own future resurrection. All right. And this is why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ did not rise from the dead, then we are still in our sins. Wow, that's pretty heavy. And then he adds, and by the way, people should feel sorry for us if we're believing against fact, contrary to fact about the resurrection. Okay, so now we have another element. The resurrection, the bodily resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth as a fundamental, as a sine qua non. And then of the five major, then resurrection I mentioned is a double entendre. It's it also makes reference to the final resurrection where everybody is raised from the dead and they are given, and there is a judgment, and there's the division between the goats and the sheep, and the goats go, one of two things happen, either perfect justice or perfect mercy. Perfect justice, punishment for everything we've ever done wrong, and God misses nothing, or perfect mercy, which is forgiveness for everything we've ever done wrong in virtue of what Christ did for us, and God misses nothing. Now, I don't know how you can take any of those elements out. One might say, okay, wait, is that punishment like eternal hell or is it destruction? Well, I think it's clearly eternal hell, but I'm willing to grant that if that's not the way you construe punishment and you think punishment is just annihilation, I think this is desperately heterodox, but I'm not sure at this point if I am willing to say that it is heretical. A heresy is something that departs from an essential, in my view at least, of the word, and I think that's a fairly safe way of putting it. A heretic cannot be a Christian by definition because that person denies an essential, which disqualifies them from salvation. And so if there is someone who believes in everything, including a day of reckoning, but believes the reckoning for non-believers is annihilation, is this person disqualified from salvation? I don't think so. I just think it's a terribly mistaken view. So that there is this reckoning is orthodoxy, and therefore I think somebody who believes in universalism, this person does not understand Christianity. If somebody believes, yes, everybody in the end is going to be saved, you're off the charts. You're off the reservation and beyond the pale. Okay, you're on the outside as far as I'm concerned. Now, you know, God ultimately makes these decisions, but asking for an assessment, that's my assessment. Now, there are two other things, I think, that I can think of right off, and I don't want to hear from you, Adam, that are implicit in all of that explanation. And one is the existence of objective morality. Because man's guilt cannot be meaningful if morality is merely relative. If morality is just a personal, mere personal opinion or judgment, if it's just about what an individual or a group feels or likes or dislikes, then there is no true moral guilt. There are just a variety of likes and dislikes. And if that's the case, there's no true moral guilt in virtue of moral relativism, then there's no true sin. And if there's no true sin, then there's nothing to be saved from. And if there's nothing to be saved from, then there's no need for a savior. So moral objectivism is a sine qua non in virtue of the fact that without it, none of the other things can be meaningful. So it's logically prior. As a requirement. And I think the other thing that's logically prior as a requirement, and I'm going to stick pretty hard by this, though I know there are some people who call themselves Christians and deny this, and that is the existence of the soul. That there is a disembodied self that's possible that leaves the body after death and goes to be with the Lord or goes into a state of retention until the final judgment, to me, is a central part of Christianity. And the idea that we are meat all the way down, and when we die, from a Christian perspective now, we just disappear, and then God recreates us, and that's called the final resurrection. I cannot comprehend in what sense that is me, that would be me at that resurrection, and not just a carbon copy made out of matter. It's not me anymore. It's only me as if I survive, I as an individual soul, survive the death of my body and endure over time until I am reunited with a physical body. So I think that the existence of the soul is also a sine qua non. So just quickly for review, we have the existence of God, man, both beautiful and broken. We have Jesus, the God-man. We have the blood atonement, and that Jesus, the God-man, did no wrong but went to a cross on our behalf, substitutionary atonement. We have the bodily resurrection of Christ. We have the future resurrection of believers to reward or judgment. And we have implicitly moral objectivism and the existence of the soul. Those are seven things that I do not see how anybody can do without in order to affirm classical Christianity.
So, yeah, that's certainly helpful. And I mean, some of those, I mean, I guess I could say they're a no-brainer, but in this day and age, I mean, it seems like almost everything's up for debate.
You're right, you unfortunately.
Know, some of my questions come to the things that are more, I guess you'd say, heterodox. I think one of you define as heretical, and some of the impetus of this question came from there was a relevant magazine article called Six Heretics Who Should Be Banned from Evangelicalism.
Wait, called what? I missed that. A relevant magazine article, and then I missed the next thing you said.
The title is Six Heretics Who Should Be Banned from Evangelicalism.
Six Heretics. Okay, got it.
And it was tongue in cheek because everyone that they chose are sort of these, really well known figures. I mean, you have C.S. Lewis. So C.S. Lewis guilty of inclusivism and rejecting the penal substitutionary atonement theory. Mm-hmm. You have like Martin Luther guilty of rejecting biblical inerrancy. William Barclay guilty of universalism. John Stott guilty of annihilationism. It seems like for the most part, this is sort of picking up things that I'm guessing you'd say are heretical.
Except for Barclay, and I don't know. Barclay was a biblical scholar, but I don't know why I need to. If he was a universalist, then my response is I don't think that he understood what Christianity is really about. Now, that sounds like a heavy challenge to a brilliant man. Maybe he understood what I mean by Christianity and he didn't believe it. Okay, fair enough. It wasn't a lack of capability on his part, but it was a lack of appropriate belief. Now, I'm not willing to say that a universalist is still within the pale. I'm not willing to say that. God ultimately decides, obviously. It's also not clear to me that C.S. Lewis rejected penal substitution, though some other view of atonement seemed to have been exemplified in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But keep in mind, he's writing fantasy. It does not mean that he is theologically committed to that view, and as I understand, he was not. He did seem to be, at least at one point, flirting with inclusivism. But inclusivism holds the idea, it at least hangs on to the idea that Jesus is the only way of salvation. Salvation could not be accomplished without him. It just balks at the idea that one has to believe in Jesus in order to be saved by Jesus. And the Roman Catholic Church is largely inclusivistic now, at least the American bishops, and as far as I can tell, the Pope. I mean, this has been the case for quite a while, since the 60s in Vatican II. So I think that is grotesquely heterodox. I don't think it's heretical. I think someone could believe that, like, and still be a genuine Christian. And same, that's true with annihilationism. That nobody goes to hell. It's just that the wicked get destroyed, they disappear, but the righteous do go to heaven. So not everybody goes to heaven, but the ones who don't just get annihilated. I think that's wrong. And John Stott was a good man. And, you know, godly, obviously, it made his contribution, I think, is mistaken. But notice where I'm drawing the line between what is essential and what is heterodox. And that article jumped on things. I don't know if they're being sensationalistic or what. And tried to, and they're drawing attention to people who had views that I would not consider heretical. Certainly, I don't believe that denying inerrancy is heretical. Although it's not clear to me that this is precisely Martin Luther's position, you know, unless they're talking about his distrust of the Book of James. I'm not sure. I got a Lutheran on staff here. I'll have to ask him what he thinks. So, But even if Martin Luther did deny inerrancy, so what? Inerrancy is not doctrinally connected to salvation. It may have a practical connection, but no, that is, it may have a practical connection to orthodoxy, such that if you deny inerrancy, man, a whole bunch of things, the dominoes begin to fall. But
right.
But it has never been a requirement to be a Christian to believe in inerrancy. It's never been
like
the church's attitude.
It seems like inerrancy ends up being more of a safeguard of orthodoxy than the qualifier for orthodoxy.
Yeah,
so.
And that's a good point. And I think inerrancy can be defended from the scripture itself. But again, we're talking about heterodoxy, not orthodoxy. And orthodoxy is specifically what you asked me about.
Yep. So that's really helpful, Greg. And I mean, I know I have other examples. And the fact of the matter is, I think you've given me some really good groundwork.
Good.
It was one of those things I was almost frustrated with myself. It seems like such a simple question.
Yeah.
But when you start working through a lot of the examples, like, okay, what about oneness Pentecostals? What about this? What about that?
Well, oneness Pentecostals deny the Trinity.
Right.
And so and I could have been a little bit more explicit when I talked about Jesus the God-man, that this entails the broader understanding of the Trinity, that the Spirit is also one of the persons of the Trinity. And keep in mind here, it was arguably the first or second council, depending on whether you count the Jerusalem Council in the Book of Acts. But the big church council of 325, this issue had to do with the deity of Christ. And later on, the Holy Spirit came in there. So the nature of God was the first thing that was as, from a council hammered out, the nature of the gospel and the nature of God. These are all really critical. So Oneness Pentecostals deny the Trinity, and therefore they would be outside of the pale on my reckoning. And it, by any person who upholds classical Christianity, I mean, this is like the, this is the foundation of the foundation. You must worship God in spirit and in truth, and anyone who denies this as revealed truth, and it is revealed in the New Testament with no lack of clarity, then they are outside of the pale. Listen, I got to run. But
thank you, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's good talking to you, Adam. Notice, friends, how I walk through that: God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection, the particular details. See how helpful that is? That's the credo sequence, and I've talked about it before, but keep your eyes open for this book, because that will go into a lot more depth on it when it comes out. All right, you're listening to Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, church, or youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California, to equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
Major in the majors, that's what I say. And there are all kinds of different things that people disagree on within the fold. It is the foundational issues that determine whether there is a fold or not, okay? And I think many folks who have raised objections about Christianity have overemphasized the differences. Alan Schliemann and I were just talking at lunch, one of our speakers here at Stand to Reason, about how fabulous it is for us to be in churches all over the country, hundreds of churches all over the country, of all kinds of different denominations, and how we're able to embrace these people as brothers and sisters in Christ without any quibble, though we may have different opinions about some of the finer points, because we're all part of the same family. And nobody fusses about these things. The fussing is wildly overstated. Yes, in some circles you get a lot of foolishness. I agree entirely, but that is not characteristic. And when some people say that it's a libel against the church. People on the inside say it's a libel against the church because there's something like 3,000 denominations of Christianity. How could that be? Well, then I'll tell you how that can be. If what that person, this Christian who's objecting, implying there's all this division, well, this person would be the person in the group that believes there should be no denominations, and another Christian would be a Christian in the group that there should be, who thinks that there should be denominations. So now at least you're going to have two denominations. Now, point being is that, you know, people have different opinions about things that are honest and genuine, and it isn't that they're divided. But if people think that you should immerse instead of sprinkle in a baptism, well, what's wrong with them hanging out together and then immersing all of their new believers? And if somebody thinks sprinkling is the right way, hey, why can't they hang out together? I was actually at a Presbyterian church last weekend, Boca Raton, Florida. Fabulous time with fabulous people. And They mentioned the order of service because you always got to check that out before you speak so you know what to expect. By the way, there's some baptisms coming up today. So we'll have the baptism first, and then you'll be able to speak. Okay, got it. And then I'm sitting down there doing the worship, and I'm looking around for the jacuzzi. There's no jacuzzi. Where are they going to baptize these people? And then a guy walks out with a bowl in his hand full of water. And I thought, how are they going to stick anybody in that bowl? Then I realized, oh, this is a Presbyterian church. They don't dip, they sprinkle. Oh. I actually have never been to a baptism like that before. But as far as I'm concerned, it was a real baptism. And they didn't get all wet. So it was a lot more tidy. And it went faster, too. That means I could get up sooner. But it was really a great thing. So why can't people who just have a different point of view about some of those kinds of things hang out together? That's not a libel against God or the church or something like that. That's just people. Anyway, there you go. All right. Columbus, Georgia. Let me find the button here. Columbus, Georgia. Eric. Hey.
Hello, Greg.
Hey, Eric. Have we talked before?
We sure have.
Okay, because I think I mentioned to you that I have a friend there named Jim Money I went fishing with.
Money, that's right.
Right, but I haven't seen him in a long time.
That's right.
In fact, he was in the boat with me when I caught my largest largemouth bass ever.
Yeah, I was bragging on you to my buddies who fish.
Oh, okay. Well, this fish jumped out. It started racing towards me, and it jumped out of the water, and it was quite a fight that I had on my hands. I won't tell you the whole story, but then Jim gave me this piece of advice when he saw that big fish come up. You know what he said?
He said, what is that?
He said, don't lose that fish. I said, thank you very much. So anyway, I caught it. We got some pictures. Like to see Jim someday, but maybe you'll run into him. I don't know. So what's on your mind today, Eric?
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that your previous callers were talking a little bit about division, some essential doctrines and things like that.
Uh-huh.
My wife and I, along with the pastor of the church that we go to, as well as the youth leader, two other pastors, we basically started, this may sound weird, a bar ministry. And I mean that in every sense of the word, bar.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it is just on a night that that the establishment was typically closed, the owner, he's a professing Christian as well, he opened the doors to us, and he basically, you know, drove home the idea of, hey, listen, if people come in here and drink, I want them to be exposed to the gospel.
Huh.
So
he gives you a night when they're normally closed, but then they open it for you to preach the gospel, and people can come in and then use the bar services? Is that right?
Yes.
Huh.
Absolutely, and it's taken off. We've had conversions, new church,
wow,
kind of member church, so to speak. You know, at least checking out the churches. You know, we're set up. Once people start asking questions, we're there, set up to basically, you know, guide them. And hey, listen, here we have this church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's kind of something, I guess, for all walks of life. And we don't, obviously, we take the stance of, hey, listen, drunkenness, you know, is we're not condoning drunkenness. Obviously,
right.
You know, we're not going to sit here and say, don't have a drink.
Right.
But we ourselves are not, you know, coasting rounds and slamming shots and, you know.
Yeah, but if you could have communion, though, and do it with a beer and a pretzel. It's a possibility, you know.
That one alone.
Adapt.
Yeah, well, so.
It sounds like it's going well, although I can imagine it would be controversial in some circles, maybe Baptistic circles, but
my church is a Baptist church.
No kidding.
It's not like most Baptist churches. Now,
well, you got that right.
My preacher calls himself a secret Calvinist, too, so. It's a little.
Were there a lot of Baptists that are Calvinists? I mean, you know, there's
right,
whole arms of the denomination of the SBC are Reformed. So think Al Mohler for a minute, you know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess really my question was: is, well, you answered the first question, was what is your, you know, what do you glean from just that scenario? And it sounds like you don't have any big bones to pick about it.
No, my question would be why. I mean, I'm just not of you, but just rhetorically, what would be the problem? Now, if I had Baptistic convictions regarding alcohol, then I can see there'd be a problem. But I don't hold those views. I don't think it's immoral to drink. So consequently, being in an establishment where drinking takes place is not a problem. I actually went to speak at a university in the South. I was picked up by a dear brother. We just hit it off right away, and he says, I'm going to take you one of the best hamburger joints in town. We pulled up, and he said, oh, by the way, just so you know, apology here, but they serve alcohol in this establishment. You know, he's kind of giving me the warning if I think I might be sullied by crossing the threshold there. And I said, well, usually that's a requirement for me at a hamburger place. So anyway, so I have no problems there whatsoever, and I'm not sure what genuine, legitimate theological objection can be sustained against what you're doing.
Right.
At least in principle.
Our target is not necessarily we don't necessarily invite the church to come to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
We invite the bar to come to the church. Yeah, so we're not saying, hey, listen, if you're not, you know, on Sunday morning, if you're not doing anything on Tuesday night, come out to the bar.
Tip back a few with us, belly up, you know.
Yeah.
But you're getting the people that are going to come to the bar anyway, but they're coming, they're coming to a church is what they're coming to, essentially.
Yeah, some unsuspectingly, others, we have kind of a regular following now. It's really the only church that they are exposed to.
Amazing.
And they love it.
It's like an unreached people group.
It really is. It really is. Well, you know, and I like this scenario. You would not preach the gospel, say, to a homeless man who was under a bridge and he happened to have a pint of whiskey that he was sipping on. You would be like, well, I'll come back when you put that down.
Yeah.
You know, I would imagine.
Good point. So,
yeah.
So tell me, you have something else in your mind. We got about 5 minutes to go.
Yes. Okay, so long story short, one of the pastors that is kind of the leader, so to speak, kind of the rally guy who really came up with this idea and kind of spearheaded it. He was given this testimony on his life and blah blah blah, and he went into this rant about how God is not in control, that he's sitting back, and then he spouted out this verse. Or half a verse, way out of context, about God does not play favorites among men.
Oh.
Because...
God is not a respecter of persons.
God is not a respecter of persons, that's right. And it's mentioned twice in the New Testament, once by Paul, once by Peter. Not even talking about that, but... So that led us to... That kind of perked a bunch of the ears with the other elders, so to speak. And so... We kind of pulled him aside, and we're like, hey, you know, listen, you're not correct on this, and, you know, God is very much involved in providence.
By the way, I don't even know how he gets the one from the other. If God is not a respecter of persons, and there's a couple different ways you could take that, but I don't see any way that you take it that would somehow imply... imply that God is not in control or he's not sovereign. I don't even know how he gets there.
Well, he used this scenario, and it almost sounded like the secularist logical problem of evil, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, if you have and he went super extreme, if you have a two-year-old over here down the street, and they're getting raped or molested, and one down here and raped or molested, and what, so God's going to intervene in one and not the other for his own purpose?
Oh, okay, I got it. I got you.
And I
got
like,
he's not
whoa.
A respecter. This person.
Yeah.
Look at, this is a pretty wild. Okay, let me offer a few thoughts. What this sounds like is a well-intentioned person who is just really making a huge mistake in the way he understands what the scripture has to say about God. It's like an untutored person jumping to conclusions that a wiser person would never jump to because they understand there's more involved in this than meets the eye. And that is not what it means when it says God is no respecter of persons. As a matter of fact, the scripture bears testimony to particular places where some people are rescued and others aren't, where God intervenes on behalf of something. That I mean, so this could not be right, and he just must have just jumped the gun in a confused way and then started making all these applications. So this person ought to be taken aside and have the way of truth explained to him more clearly. Now,
yeah,
the,
we did that, but his rebuttal to the 14 or 15 verses showing that events happen according to God's purpose, he basically he told me that my problem was that I was sola scriptura and he was scripture and feeling.
Okay, well, okay, my opinion, 60 seconds, this guy should not be on the team, period.
Right.
I'm sorry to have to say that since he was instrumental in getting this thing started, but this guy, his foundation is wrong. Scripture plus feelings, there is no place to preach as the Word of God, that is authoritative information about God from merely your feelings, regardless of what Scripture says, and that's what he's doing. He's taking a Scripture and he's reading into it his own meaning. He's ignoring the other texts that bring balance to the discussion, and then he's just brushing you guys off when you bring appropriate correction on him. This is not a good sign in a number of different ways. Not only is his understanding of Christianity flawed, but his wisdom is lacking, and the fact that he is unwilling, from what I could tell, to come to heel on this, even after some of the leadership has talked to him, that's a trifecta, man. This is bad. Now, it doesn't mean he's not, in a certain sense, redeemable for the circumstances, but he's going to have to humble himself and accept the appropriate correction that you are offering him as a team. And gosh, I don't have time to talk to you about this, but I hope it isn't the head pastor that you're talking about. But I know he's a principal involved what you're doing, but this is not a good sign, Eric. So I got a break with you right now. End of the hour. Thank you for your call, and maybe in a couple of months you can get back to me and let me know what eventuated. But a lot of important things there for all of you to chew on. All right, an interesting way to end an hour. I've still got more time ahead. If you don't get the show, the whole thing in your market, go to str.org and podcast or to iTunes. Doesn't matter to me. Just get it and don't miss a single episode. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Hello, my friends. The show is Stand to Reason. The host, Greg Kokel, that would be me. And, last hour, and I don't know if you're just picking this up as the first hour in your market, but last hour was fabulous. And if you missed it, I hope you can get it. But it's just got me rolling here. I almost want to jump right into phone calls. But I have something to share with you here on Stand to Reason that relates to something I said last week as I opened the show that I just want you to hear. And for the most part, I am going to be reading something to you that someone else wrote. And it's a letter of thanks to me. And I always feel a little bit uncomfortable doing this because I don't want you to think I'm trying to somehow showboat, grandstand or whatever. That's not my heart. But I think that this piece is captures something that it might be helpful for you to hear. Now, last week when I kicked off the show, I talked about my daughter's first day of school. My daughters go to a Christian school, specifically a Trivium Classical School. And I don't mean to sound all hoity-toity, but it's just a place that really tries to integrate the Christian worldview in everything. And it follows a medieval educational motif called the Trivium. And so you could say that my daughter's school is still stuck in the Middle Ages, which I think is a good thing. And how the first day of school, starting with the chapel and the things that were covered in the chapel, like starting with the Gloria Patri, everybody's standing with arms, or the children are standing with arms raised, singing the Gloria Patri, which is a type of doxology. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and the Holy Ghost, who was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, something to that effect. I don't know it by heart because I don't sing it every morning like my girls do, but they know it. And then talking about the chief end of man being to glorify God and to enjoy him forever and the other things that were included in and the sense of deep satisfaction and safety my wife and I feel for our children who are being taught by friends who share our worldview, our deep convictions about the nature of reality. And that, as I put it then, no education is neutral. There is no neutrality when it comes to these kinds of things. Every point of view, I should say, every kind of education, it comes from the perspective of a point of view. And so it's that point of view is ultimately going to influence in some measure how the education of the children is done. Either by its presence, that is, the point of view, is going to dictate certain things are taught in a certain way or certain things are said in particular ways, broadly political correctness, if you want to think of it, one of the categories, or that view is going to leave things out, and therefore it will educate by absence. And both of them are powerful ways of educating, and no matter what one's worldview is, that view will be communicated. So for those who are thinking, well, our public school is a pretty good public school, and there are a lot of good ones in many regards. There's no question about that. Nice people who have lots of virtues, etc. They do a good job in the kind of education they do. I don't deny that at all, but even so, there is a worldview that is going to be subtly communicated that is going to be hostile to the Christian worldview. And it may be more subtle than most. Some schools are not as aggressive, but you can't avoid it. I personally don't want that for my girls. And so, thankfully, we are in a position to send our children to a private school. And thankfully, it turns out not to be that expensive. We can manage it. But I did say, I think, that my wife and I would sacrifice quite a bit to be able to send our children there. Now, I hope anybody from the school administration is not listening so that they want to increase our prices, but you get my point. So I said all of these things, and I guess I don't know, I might have said something like this last week, but I don't at all mean to be putting any kind of guilt trip on anyone for the way they school their children. You are responsible before God with the circumstances that you find yourself in to educate your kids. And I have my values, I have my reasons. If my values influence your values or my reasons influence your actions, then all right, good. But I'm not trying to put anybody down, okay? That's my spirit. So with that as a backdrop, I want to read to you a letter I received just a couple days ago from a mom who is a Christian mom and who is a homeschooling mom, or at least she's and her husband are setting up to do homeschooling for their children as a way of avoiding the difficulty of having some other worldview influence the education of their children in a way that might be harmful to them. And homeschooling is really hard, it seems to me. Now, I'm sure we have homeschool listeners that are thinking, well, you know, it's hard, but the rewards are fabulous, and you know, it's worth the trouble and XYZ, right? And others might be saying, yeah, we're homeschooling our kids, but boy, oh boy, it is really a challenge. Okay, I understand that, and I understand that. And it may be that because of the challenge, some of you have wondered whether or not you ought not just kind of go with the flow and use the public education that you've already paid for, let's face it, and then just, you know, wave the white flag. So this was somewhat the circumstance that our listener found herself in, and I'm not going to give you any more introduction. Let me just read what she wrote, and then you can just be served by her thoughts. All right. She writes, Thursday last week was a rough day in Momland. Just Thursday is what I think, but no, okay, Thursday. I failed to get up and going before my kids, and for me this usually means I am playing catch-up all day. I didn't have an aim for the day. Our baby decided to take the opportunity to eat much more often than usual, and so our routine was out of whack. And my 2 5-year-olds were bored to tears and solved their boredom by bickering with each other constantly. I didn't get a chance to have a meal, let alone a shower, until mid-afternoon, and generally felt like the worst version of myself as a person, mother, wife, you name it. I called my husband in tears, pleading with him, or perhaps with myself, to change our minds about homeschooling that would be starting in a week. I was convinced that not only couldn't I do it, I didn't want to. I watched all my friends on the street happily walk their kiddos to the school bus, which a good family friend is driving this year, wave goodbye, and have a day to themselves to get things done, have a break, run errands without tag-alongs. The ease, the simplicity, the peace and quiet. Now, there are probably a whole lot of you folks that can identify with this, or especially moms. Man, rough day in Momland. She continues, thoughts began to invade, like perhaps I couldn't give my daughters everything they needed for their education, like socialization or PE or a reading group and all the other things I enjoyed about school as a child, but that my girls would not experience in the same way through a homeschool co-op. I started a spiral into imagining that I would perhaps be harming them by homeschooling and that I would certainly drive myself nuts. Suffice it to say, by bedtime, my heart was heavy about the decision we had already made. As I prayed in the shower the next morning, heart still heavy, I asked that God would break through the emotions and the mental fog and bring clarity and direction for me in regards to school, that he would show me the why, if indeed the classical homeschool co-op is still the best course to pursue at this time, even if it is the most challenging. As I got ready for the day, I decided to listen to a sermon podcast, but for some reason, our church website was down. So I thought I'd double-check the STR site for any podcast I'd missed. Imagine my curiosity when I saw the title of the newest podcast, The First Day of School. So that would be last week's first hour, Stand to Reason's show. And then she writes personally to me, "Greg, your words literally brought tears to my eyes and fresh hope to my heart. The truth that there is no such thing as a neutral education struck me to the core. And as I heard you describe the first day's chapel, the instruction and the singing and the praying afterwards, my heart was tenderized with the fresh realization that academics are secondary to what my husband and I really value in our educational aim for our girls. It is the development of the soul, providing a firm foundation not only for this life but for the life to come. That's our highest priority. The weight of this responsibility is at times crushing, but I believe that God crushes us to rebuild us into his likeness, and that he promises to carry the burden with us. Let me be crushed," she writes, "and rebuilt for my children, the most precious of burdens I will ever carry." Wow. Then she says, as she's closing, "I'm so grateful that while we don't have the ability at this time to send our girls to a Christian school," sounds like financial liabilities, I don't know, but she says, "we do have the opportunity to homeschool them with a fabulous classical Christian co-op. I trust that as we proceed, even though aspects of this path seem daunting at present, I am confident that God will bring provision in ways I can't expect or anticipate from this vantage point. I believe that simply being faithful to him will bring joy, peace, and fulfillment to our family. And hey, maybe I will absolutely love educating at home. Regardless, after listening to your podcast and discussing it afterwards with my husband, we are renewed in our conviction that this is the best path for us at present, that we must educate our precious girls in light of eternity with the best of our ability as God gives us grace to do so. Thank you for sharing your experiences this week. It has truly made a difference in our lives and in the lives of our girls. I'm very grateful. All the best." And she signs off. What a sweet, dear letter. It really helped make my day today. It was really an encouragement. Partly because, you know, sitting behind a microphone, you never know what's going to resonate with people. And that line, "there is no such thing as a neutral education," I've said that many times. I actually got the line from Doug Wilson, who helped formulate the educational school system that my children's school belongs to. So that thought came from him. It influenced me. I got to thinking about it and just made it its way into my own vocabulary, which made it into this person's heart and served her well. And I'm just glad to hear that. But I hope that maybe some things that she has written here will be an instruction and an encouragement to many of you who are struggling right now with your commitments to your children's education, and the choices that you're making are burdensome, but make it possible for your children to be prepared not just for time, but for eternity, just as this writer put it. So it encouraged me. I hope it encourages you as well. Let's Brooke, let's go quickly to break here. We're going to break out a little early, and then I'll get to your calls. Incidentally, if you'd like to give me a call during the live show, which is on Tuesday afternoons from 4 until 7 p.m. Los Angeles time, the number is 855-243-9975. If you're outside of the U.S., and we do have callers from different places on the globe, one Sunday in the past I had calls from four different continents, that number is 562-424-8255. 800-228-2229. Those numbers will get you Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Greg Kokel here, giving you a piece of my mind as I do every, well, live show, Tuesday night, 4 until 7. Just a reminder, 3 weeks left for Rethink Apologetics Youth Conference. Just found out last hour somebody's coming from Idaho. There are students driving down to Orange County for September 26th and 27th, Rethink Apologetics Youth Conference from Idaho. As of like 3 or 4 days ago, we have 598 students already signed up. I know whole groups of students are coming, like one whole youth group or a whole bunch of people from a youth group and their youth group leader are coming down. They're making a road trip, and we're just thrilled to hear that. You can still get in pre-conference registration, $39. That's for Friday night events, all-day Saturday events, Brett Kunkel, Alan Schliemann, Sean McDowell, me, J.P. Jones, Tim Barnett. I mean, it's going to be quite a conference. So go to rethinkapologetics.com, rethinkapologetics.com. You can get all the information. Sign up. Look forward to seeing you there. Let's see. Let's go to La Mesa, California, I presume. Let me find the button. Is that Carl? Is that La Mesa, California, down in San Diego County? Okay.
Yes.
Good. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. Last time I saw my doctor, he saw that I was reading a book, Know Why You Believe, by Paul Little.
Yes.
And I guess in his, he kind of misconstrued the title or meaning of the book, I think, because of an issue that's been bugging him, apparently. So he's asking me to, why are humans religious? And
uh-huh.
He said he's going to be, long story short, reading a book by some anthropologist kind of on the subject. And he said maybe in my next appointment we can get together and compare notes.
Oh, good.
I have some ideas, like directions I could go with him. His background is Jewish and so on.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering what you had in mind, what you might contribute
sure.
there.
Yeah, I never heard that take, know why you believe. And, of course, Paul Little meant know the reasons why you believe.
Yeah.
And the other take would be, what are the emotional motivations to be religious?
Yeah.
And, of course, that's not what Paul Little had in mind. That never occurred to me. But, of course, a lot of people approach the whole spiritual religious enterprise that way, particularly people who are skeptics or maybe atheists. And what they want to look at is they want to look at the emotional reasons or the psychological reasons or the sociological reasons that people might be driven to believe in something instead of looking at the reasons for the belief. So the first would be psychology, sociology. The second one would be, you know, religious reflection proper. You know, why the first one is why emotionally might someone want to believe in God? God's a crutch. But that doesn't tell you anything about God. It only tells you about people's psychology. It may be that God actually exists regardless of the fact that many people believe are motivated to believe in him because he satisfies some kind of emotional need. So I suspect it's sometimes hard to know, you know, how to proceed with a person like this. Is he an atheist?
I don't know. His background is definitely Jewish. I think he may be an observant Jew. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what type of Jew he would be or anything.
Right. Well, if he is an observant Jew, this means he takes the Torah seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Torah, that would be the first five books of Moses, does give a very defensible plausible explanation for why people are religious. And the reason the Torah gives, I think, is because human beings are unique creatures in that they share the imprint of God.
Yeah.
They are made in God's image. And we see that in the first page of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And then repeated on in chapter 9 of Genesis, we see that capital punishment is initiated precisely because human beings are specially made in God's image. And so if man sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God, God created man.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is this, it is in virtue of this inherent dignity that human beings have, that we have moral obligations to each other, and we also have a hunger or a thirst for the divine. Augustine, I think, there's a couple of people who have offered a reflection like this, but I think Augustine's is probably the most well-known, and it goes something like, Lord, you have made us for yourselves, and our souls are restless until they find their rest in thee. So there's a possible platform for discussion. Why is it that human beings are religious? Why is it that it is unique among human beings that that there is this thirst for the divine? And the answer that the Torah gives, you might suggest, is completely plausible to me, and that is that we were made for God. We are made like God in some way, so it's possible for us to have a friendship with him, and therefore we hunger for that friendship that we are currently estranged from. So that's a way to go. Now, that's working from the existential, that is our own experience of things, to a credible explanation for why the world is the way it is. If somebody is a materialist, all they could do is talk about how we maybe fear death or we fear the unknown or something like that, so we invent a God to make us feel better. But I have a rejoinder to that, and that is, why would anyone invent God to make them feel better when the God, especially in the case of the Judeo-Christian tradition, is a God that is very demanding? If we were going to invent God, it seems to me we'd invent a God much more like us rather than the God that we find in the pages of Scripture. So that doesn't strike me as persuasive at all. One thing that's compelling about the Scripture is the God that we find there is so much unlike us He is not made in our image. It's the other way around. So we didn't invent him. He invented us. That's, it seems to me. So there's grounds for discussion there.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a way to go. If he's raised in a Jewish tradition, it might be fair to ask him why he does not consider Jesus as the Messiah. And I mean Jewish religious tradition. And he might say, well, I'm Jewish. And I say, yeah, I know that. So, and you're asking him for more explanation than just, well, Jews don't believe in Jesus. I know that Jews don't characteristically believe in Jesus. My question is, why not? And so you want to kind of, if this is a direction you're going to go, you want to try to get past the kind of cultural excuse that he might use and try to get down to bare bones. What is the reason? There must be a reason that you guys don't think that Jesus is the Messiah. And then he might say, well, give me a reason why I should think he is the Messiah. And then you could say he rose from the dead. Now, this is a claim that is a controversial claim that needs some defense. And this is where you can get different books that are on the market. I don't know if you in apologetics books and whatever that I think are really, really good. Lee Strobel's comes to mind, The Case for the Resurrected Christ, I think, is the title. And it's a very handy argument that he outlines there that can be used. But see, this allows you to go to something very specific that can be defended from the historical texts without getting into a lot of theology, you know? Well, because Jesus rose from the dead, he predicted his own resurrection. He got crucified. The tomb was empty. The disciples saw him. What's the best explanation for these things? No other explanation is going to work. It's not going to be plausible except for the one that the disciples themselves gave. He who is dead is risen. And if he rose from the dead, that pretty much seals it as far as messiahship. I mean, what more could a person ask for in terms of credibility, of evidence? What more could a person ask for than a resurrection? And if you can get on to the topic of the resurrection, he's willing to talk about it. I'm presuming that your friend is willing to engage you in thoughtful discussion about these spiritual matters.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, then you've got a very precise thing to discuss. Is it reasonable to believe that Jesus of Nazareth was dead at one point of time and alive at some point of time afterwards? That's the only question. And once you can figure that out, it seems to me, I mean, if you answer that question, if you're able to answer it yes, based on the evidence, it seems to me that that has theological significance. Huh. Yeah, and you can move from there. So this, there are a dozen ways you could go with any person, maybe more than that. I mean, dozens of ways. But I just two have come to mind since we've been talking, and given that he is some kind of religious Jew, and he's asking the question about why are people religious, you can point him back to the Torah and say, well, there's an explanation right there, because God made us for himself. We bear his image. We are like him in some way. And just like you and I, Carl, are attracted to other human beings in a way that's unique, that we are not attracted to other creatures. They are like us. We seek a fellowship and a communion with those that are like us, even though we might like our Fido and Mew Mew and whatever, you know, all our pets. Still, human beings are special and unique, have a special place for our yearning to be close with. Because they are like us, we have a yearning to be close with God because we are like him. That makes sense, and that's what the Torah says. That's one line of argument. The second line is asking or pursuing, why is it that he doesn't believe Jesus is Messiah? Not the cultural reasons, but the actual rationale why Jesus ought to be rejected. And if you could then advance the idea that here's one good reason to believe that he rose from the dead. Now you've got a specific issue you can focus on that has been very well developed. I mean, those are two ideas.
Okay, thanks a lot. Great.
Carl, give me a call back after you had a couple of conversations. Let me know how it went, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, I'd look forward to hearing from you.
All right. thanks.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Boise, Idaho. And Chris, I just mentioned that there's some people driving down from Idaho, I think, that are going to be part of the Rethink Conference. So that wouldn't be your group, would it?
No, it wouldn't, but I am associated with a church who, you know, and in their youth ministry, and I sure would love to have brought them and bring them. I'm planning on making a big push to do it next year.
Okay. All right. That's good. You still got 3 weeks now. May not be enough time to plan for that group, but to make such a long road trip. But
right.
Next year,
right.
For sure. We'll be back.
Yes. Yes, for sure.
So what's on your mind?
I'm 44, and I've been deciding what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Okay.
And, you know, the only thing that really has lit me up my whole life for the last 20 years has been the church, Christianity, apologetics. And I really think that I want to devote the rest of my time on this planet being heavily involved with, you know, more church things as opposed to just mm-hmm. doing church on Wednesday nights or Sundays and, you know, just living a Christian life. I want to be more impactful. So I was considering, I am a graduate from Biola.
Uh-huh.
And I was considering going back for my master's in apologetics.
All right.
And I being in Idaho, they do offer the distance learning program.
That's right. And their program is without parallel. I am really thrilled to see programs popping up around the country. Denver Seminary, I think, has one. Southern Evangelical Seminary, now Houston Baptist. And there are other places. I think Calvary Chapel has some kind of program. I don't know. I'm mm-hmm. thrilled to see them popping up all over the place, but
so
I'll just say so Biola is the program to beat. And all I mean there is I think that on balance, they've got the best package. They've got the speakers, they got the history, they got the background, they've got the feasibility because they've got the online program. So I'm a little bit biased, but...
Well, I am too. I got my bachelor's there in 2000.
Yeah, so I'm also thrilled that you're gung-ho and being part of the active third column there with your boots on the ground and making a difference
right.
in your community. Good for you.
That's right. Well, thank you. And it's a large part of that belongs, you know, goes to your credit because I've been a Timothy to your Paul for many, many, probably
well,
a decade or more now.
Thank you. That's sweet. I'm glad to hear that.
The other question I had was, what do you think about, because there have been other schools who offer an MDiv.
Right.
And do you think it's that, well, how might I be better used or better, more useful in the kingdom, you know, would
okay.
I be,
sure.
as far
okay.
as marketable skills?
Right. Well, that last phrase was an important one, and you had not mentioned that yet, the marketable skill. In fact, I was thinking when you're saying, I want to devote the rest of my life, you know, to be significantly involved with the local church in apologetics, I was thinking to ask you, I hope have you figured out a way you're going to make a living while you do that, you know, because having even a master's degree in apologetics is not necessarily a meal ticket. And so that's a separate question. And
right.
it is a rare circumstance, I think, that people who get training in apologetics are able to ply their trade and make a living at it. Now, with the recent development of Ratio Christi, which is a new organization on campuses now, specifically devoted to the task of apologetics in the local life of the Christian on campus and in influencing the non-Christian, this has opened a lot more doors for people with training in apologetics to, you know, raise their support and be a part of an apologetics ministry. But that's a good development from a professional perspective. But if you're asking now, what's the best way to make a living? Well, an MDiv, that's a master's in divinity. And let me just back up and clarify. There are masters in apologetics. There are masters in theology. That's an MA theology.
Right.
And there are masters in divinity. Here's the difference between the last two. In the Masters of Theology, you get lots of great theological training. In the Masters of Divinity, MDiv programs are specifically designed to put you in the pastorate. And that means you're going to have to develop skills unique to pastoral work, particularly to pastoral preaching, which means if you get an MDiv, you got to get the languages. You're going to get a lot of training in Greek, and you're going to get a lot of training in Hebrew. You got to have it if part of your job on a regular basis is going to the text and preaching and teaching. So the big difference between the MDiv and the MA is the languages. If you do not want to be a professional preacher, but you want to be involved in full-time ministry, then an MDiv is not your choice. It might be an MA theology. It might be an MA in apologetics, but it's not going to be an MDiv because you're going to learn a bunch of stuff. You have to spend a lot of time studying stuff you really probably will not use on a regular basis. And the result of that is it will atrophy and you will lose all of that effort that you put into it, just like I did for my two terms of Greek.
I appreciate that because I do want to spend more time, with the people counseling and assisting it,
right,
helping people at discipleship situations, whereas I don't know if Hebrew and Greek would be as useful in those situations.
No, if you're going to be a head pastor, that's one thing. If that's what your long-term goal is, I think you'd be better served in probably, especially given the sentiments you've expressed, I think you'd be better served getting an MA in apologetics. Because at Biola, and you're going to have to look closer at the program, I can't tell you for sure, but
sure,
at Biola, you're going to have elective courses. I don't know what their core looks like, if their core requires certain theological courses. I should ask, because Amy, you have an MA in apologetics from Biola, right? Does the core require base Theo 1, Theo 2, Theo 3, that kind of stuff, or are those taken as electives? That's part of the core. She thinks it's part of the core. So in any event, there are always going to be electives in any coursework, so you can supplement your apologetic material with theological material if you like, in addition to whatever core is required there at Biola theologically. Point being, if you get an MA apologetics, you're going to get apologetics and theology, and you won't have to mess with the languages. Pardon me. You're going to get them both. And here's what I think that's going to do. This is going to make you a very valuable candidate for the local church environment. Local churches are buying up pastors. That's what they do. They add to their pastoral staff. What can you bring to the table? Well, you can bring what everybody else can bring, some theological training, which is really important. But it's a feather in your cap to have some training in apologetics. I'm just thinking of my buddy Jonathan Noyes at our church, atheist turned Christian, got his MA in apologetics and was serving our local church faithfully while he was making a living with his family. And as they began expanding their staff, they grabbed Jonathan. That was a no-brainer. Because he was faithful to the local church, giving his time, helping where he could, blooming where he was planted. You probably heard that before.
I have. That's another story. Okay. Yeah.
And so when the opening came up, here's a guy that could meet the need, and he has some teaching skills too. And so he'd filled in a few times as a fill-in speaker for the pastor, and so they grabbed him, and now he fills in still for the pastor. Now I think he's in charge of the local Ratio Christi at Pepperdine University, which is just over the hill from where we're at. So this guy is one happy camper right now, because he paid his dues and he was faithful in the little things, and when an opening came up, he got snatched up. And that's a great example of trying to develop, so a person who's willing to develop themselves and develop their craft, bloom where they're planted, and rise to the top. And I think that probably from what you told me and what your sentiments are, if you get an MA in apologetics, it's going to make, and then you begin to bloom with that, wherever you happen to be. This is going to make it a much easier situation for you to participate in a local church staff and make your living that way, or possibly focus entirely in apologetics if something like that comes along. You'll have both opportunities.
Great.
Make sense?
I appreciate the time.
All right, Chris. Advice. Yeah, it's great talking to you. And you stay in touch, all right?
I will. Thank you.
Okay, appreciate that call. Let's go to break. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
According to recent statistics, one out of every four college professors is a professing atheist or agnostic. The majority of professors view the Bible as an outdated book filled with myths. More than half of college professors have unfavorable feelings towards evangelical Christians. When your students head off to college, will they be ready for the people who are waiting for them? Let Stand to Reason help. We've designed a student conference to equip your youth. Join us for the Rethink Student Apologetic Conference in Southern California on September 26th and 27th. For more information or to register, check out rethinkapologetics.com.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Reasonable, sensible, fair discussion. That's what I'm after here. Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host. And lots of folks in line here. Let's hear from, why don't you pull Chris down so I don't say the wrong name here. And it's Orlando, Florida. Dana, hello, sir. Or
hi.
Ma'am, sorry. Okay, I got a new recruit in here for Melinda, so she didn't put the sex symbol up there, so I know Dana's not a guy but a girl. My apologies, ma'am.
That's okay.
Okay, glad to have you aboard.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks so much for your time, and I really appreciate your ministry. I have benefited from STR for many years since I was an undergraduate student.
No kidding.
I'm now completing law school. I have 3 more months to go.
Wow, congratulations.
I'm not a traditional student. I'm 35, but I'm doing it anyway.
Well, good for you. You know what? The traditional students are no longer the traditional students, from what I can tell.
Right.
I bet you there's a lot of people that are more midlife, you know, or up kind of like you, not 20, 25, but older. Lots of people like you going back to school and doing what you're doing. So I tip my hat to you.
Thank you. Well, this question is not a relationship question per se, but it is definitely part of it. So I don't know how much you know about the so-called dating scene, Greg, but it's hard out there.
Well, I was in the dating scene until 4 days before my 48th birthday. So now it's been 16 years now, but I have sympathy for you.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm being pursued by a gentleman who is a Christian, professing Christian. Mm-hmm. I've been a Christian since my sophomore year in college, and we had a discussion recently, and he revealed that he believes that homosexuals are born that way. Mm-hmm. He doesn't see why God would allow them to have that desire so strong, cannot be shaken, and then condemn them.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that, you know, he's persuaded by that. And I have a totally different view. I believe in morality. I believe in sin. And I told him I believe that while I don't understand everything about sexuality, about the world, about the Bible, I have this conviction that there is a better way and indeed a best way, and that is for a man to be with a woman. And I said, so, you know, I explained that just because I have that conviction doesn't mean I can't love homosexuals.
Right.
I don't love them. I don't walk around pointing the finger. I hug them, embrace them, all of that.
Uh-huh.
And so I guess, you know, this individual and I, we get along great. He's an intellectual. We're compatible.
Mm-hmm.
But in with this issue, which we both feel very strongly about, my question is, one, how do I answer him?
Mm-hmm.
Two, can you, and I know this question, even forming it, I feel somewhat foolish for asking it, but can you be a Christian and hold such a view?
Yes.
And,
well, simple answer there is yes. Okay. So
okay.
I'll dispatch with that right away. But then there's the other question is, regardless of that, you still, there's a question about, in a sense, deeper or ultimate compatibility, given these spiritual differences, I imagine, right?
Well, sure.
Okay. Now, let me just deal with these quickly. I'm looking at the clock, and it's ticking here. I think I've got about 10 minutes, so and a lot of ground to cover, so I want to do your question justice. Born that way, okay? He is convinced they're born that way. It is entirely fair, and you'll be on very familiar ground here, given your legal training. It is entirely fair to ask this person what it is that has convinced him that homosexuality is constitutional, that it is, it's built in to the genetic structure or something akin to that, into the way you're born.
I did ask him.
And he said, pardon me, he said what?
He said two things. One, he's well-read, so he reads a lot of science, a lot of research. He said there's, you know, research fairly recent that suggests it is genetic. And then, two, he's provided me with a lot of anecdotes. He says, look, Dana, I have a lot of people I've known over the years who are thriving, happy, they've adopted children, they're in homosexual relationships for many, many years, and I just don't see why. They tell me, look, this is who I am. I can't love a woman. Or,
wait,
you know,
wait, okay, but I'm just going to back up for a second, because the question is, and so we're just going to stick, you know, objection, counselor, we're going to stick here with the point. The point is, the question is, what are the reasons he thinks they were born that way? Now, I understood the first point.
That's
in play. But the second one is, and I've known many, many people who are very, very happy and have strong convictions. They could never feel any differently and blah, blah, blah. Irrelevant to the question, counselor. It is not relevant to the question of whether or not they're born that way, that they now feel like they can't change and they're very happy. That may answer a different question, but that's not the question on the table, okay? Is this is this person a fellow law student with you?
No.
Okay.
Right.
Well,
professional.
I'm just playing along here, you know, for fun. But you get the point here. The anecdotes do not serve to answer the question. They may be very happy, and they may say that they can't change. But the fact is that massive numbers of people who are experiencing same-sex attraction change spontaneously with no counseling of any kind. This is on the record. This happens. So whether or not they can change, this is irrelevant. This is irrelevant to the question at hand, okay? Now, as far as the research, I am, and look, we and Alan Schliemann especially traffics a lot with this, but the research is decisive that homosexuality is not genetic. And there is no gay gene that has ever been found. And the twins study, that identical twins that share the same genetic thing, show decisively that it is not genetic. Now, I can tell you a website to go to. The acronym is NARTH. NARTH.
Yeah.
Okay, NARTH. I don't know what it stands for. I just remember the acronym.
Yes, I'm familiar.
Okay, but they're going to give you, the guy who's a principal there, literally, and I'm using the word literally, lives within walking distance from my house. My wife and I had dinner with him about 6 months ago. You can walk to his house. You know, I used to jog basically right past it when I'd run in my neighborhood. But that guy, and I'm trying to think of his name. I'll think of it in just a minute. But he works with people with same-sex attraction. This is what he does for a business. His name is Anathema in the academic community because they hate people who say what he says. But he's got the facts on this. And there is we are learning more and more about what the cause is. It is developmental. It isn't like somebody just woke up and says, I think I'll be homosexual today. It's not choice. It is developmental like most psychological dispositions. It is not genetic. So he's just flat out wrong there, but you're going to have to get your you know chapter and verse squared away or else he's not going to listen to you. But even if it is genetic, look, there are thalidomide babies. Remember them from the 50s where mom took the thalidomide and then she had babies?
Yeah.
She had genetic mutations, okay? The babies were born without arms or legs. Is that genetic? Yes. Does that make this good? No.
Right.
I have a, what, genetic disposition towards women. It doesn't mean that I can have any woman that I want, that all of my sexual desires determined by my genetic makeup are good. The connection is not there. You can't get an ought from an is. Just because, even if it were genetic, just because it is natural for them to feel that way doesn't mean that it is right to feel that way, all right? So he's, and I'm moving a little quickly here, but he's guilty of a logical fallacy at this point, okay? Now, the real question, if he is a Christian, oh, Nicolosi, thank you. It's Joseph Nicolosi, N-I-C-O-L-O-S-I, Joseph Nicolosi, and he's got a son named Joe, who also is in the business. And he showed me stacks of letters written from clients who had unwanted same-sex attraction, who no longer have it. And he showed the pictures of their wives, in the case of male homosexuals, and their families. So, and this wasn't an in vitro fertilization. This is the regular way, all right? Let's first tell the truth, then give your opinion, is what Dennis Prager says. The facts of the matter are it's not genetic and it's not immutable, period.
So, Greg, how could you, you started off by saying, just to answer my first question, that yes, you can be a Christian and hold this view.
Okay, well, that is, a person's salvation is not related to whether or not they're confused on this issue. But this raises another question, and this is the one that really matters here. So let's zero in on it. This isn't about science. This isn't about genetics. This isn't about political correctness. Your friend testifies to being a follower of Christ of some sort. The Bible is our guide for those inside of the faith. So then why is it he is siding with the secularists against Scripture? That is the most important question for you.
Well, he answered that actually, Greg.
All right, I'm curious.
he said that he has a very high IQ, okay? So he's the type to really dig and think critically and read a lot. So he said, Dana, I'm a Christian, I believe the Bible, but I've read a lot about the Bible. I know how it came together. And I just feel that, you know, it has to be read in context of the times it was written.
Of course.
Not everything is there we take literally. Not
of
everything.
Course.
So he has that approach. And so he's open, because he's very much a critical thinker, he's open to the possibility that, listen, what may have been said in Leviticus, maybe it's just not pertinent now, or maybe it doesn't apply.
Okay,
that
he is exactly right in principle on all of those things. But it isn't just Leviticus. It is Sodom and Gomorrah. And then Leviticus. Sodom and Gomorrah is before the law. In Leviticus, what Leviticus says is, don't do these things that were done by the people that I drove out before you. These are not Jews. These are Gentiles. They were told, and if you do these things, I'm going to drive you out too. And that's pretty serious. That doesn't seem like it's tied to the Levitical priesthood or anything like that. And it's also in Romans chapter 1. And it's tied to the order of creation And it's crystal clear there that the man disregarded the natural function of the woman, is the literal rendering. God made woman for man. Man denied that and turned to other men to satisfy that. Paul identifies that in Romans 1 and there in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 as well. This isn't just a stray verse that can be misunderstood. He's right in principle on all the things you said. You must read it in context. You must understand it in the context of the culture. Just because it's in Leviticus doesn't mean that it applies to us today. True, but you still have to deal with the specifics. Then you have to go back to the text, read them in their context, understand the circumstances in which they're written, and the fact that, you know, just because it's in Leviticus doesn't mean it's for us. And even with all of those things taken into consideration, homosexuality is condemned by God. And the reason it's condemned because of what Jesus says from the beginning, and I just got to close with this, and maybe you can call back another time and we could talk about it more. But the reason that it says that Jesus says in Matthew, he says, from the beginning, it has not been this way, but man, they were created male and female, okay? And where the two become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man pull asunder. So therefore, you've got it. Jesus says it clearly. Did Jesus say anything about homosexuality? There it is. God's plan is a male and female, one flesh, never torn apart. Nothing else in the scripture is approved by God sexually, marriage-wise. That's from the lips of Jesus. So he's not going to be able to get out from underneath this. Incidentally, let me recommend a book for you by Michael Kruger, who's been on the show before, K-R-U-G-E-R. This is a book on the canon. All right. And I appreciate the intelligence of your dear friend and all his study. The problem is, it seems to me, is that his intelligence and his study are not serving him well to come to sound answers so far regarding this issue. And also, this will have ramifications for other issues. That is, theological and conduct issues related to sexuality that you need to be asking yourselves, is his method of understanding these ultimate issues going to create other problems for you theologically and morally down the line? I don't know. I can't answer that. You're going to have to answer that for yourself. But Dana, thank you so much for your question. And God bless you. I want to hear back from you before too long, and we'll see if we can explore this more. That's it for this hour, friends. Thanks for being with me here on Stand to Reason. Hello, friends, and welcome to Stand to Reason. This is actually our last hour of the live broadcast, so I'm beginning the third hour. Again, I just need to make this reminder, if you've missed any hours because of the way you're getting your broadcast, you need to get the podcast. We have had a fabulous show up to this time. I wanted to talk another 20 minutes with this dear woman in Florida who was finishing up her legal training and dating and dealing with another Christian who had some unusual beliefs. And hopefully she'll call back at another time. But this is the kind of stuff we deal with. Stock and trade at Stand to Reason. Bright people calling in with significant challenges and questions and difficulties to work through. My goal always, of course, to champion classical Christianity, but not just to do it mindlessly, is to reason through it and to show that the Christian worldview has explanatory power, and that understanding the facts here are always going to lead to a defense, if you will, or an establishment of the Christian worldview. I'm digging for words here. A support of it, a shoring up of it. It's our understanding of reality has unbelievable explanatory power, like nothing else. And that's why we never have to be afraid of the facts. And maybe all the facts don't come in on something, and maybe the research is still up in the air. That's all right. I'm going to stick with the tried and true. Yeah, which usually comports with common sense, by the way, and that's and that makes things a lot easier for us. The obvious conclusions turn out to be the Christian ones, and we were just talking about homosexuality, for example, and big issue now, same-sex marriage. What could be more obvious than that human beings were made male and female, one for the other? One for the other. And this is what Jesus said, too, in Matthew. From the beginning, it has not been this way. Now, he's speaking specifically of divorce and remarriage. And his point was to appeal back to the creation order to try to answer this question. God made them male and female to be joined together in one flesh, and what God has joined together, let no man tear asunder. So it is a man and a woman joined sexually for life. That's marriage. That's his point. So it had a ramification for divorce. It also has a ramification, the same truth, for what for what we're dealing with here about homosexuality and same-sex marriage. The point I'm making is you don't need Jesus to tell you that. Jesus is making an observation not as the incarnate Son of God, but as a reasonably intelligent human being. I think he was the incarnate Son of God, but you don't have to be incarnate Son of God to see the obvious. Men and women were made a certain way, and they're made for each other sexually. And when they join together, they create a bond that, because of the nature of human gestation, requires for the best conditions and lifelong commitment. And if not, then children suffer. I mean, I'm just speaking humanistically now. I'm not even speaking theologically. The point I'm making is the theology of the Christian worldview comports with common sense almost always. There's nothing to be ashamed of here. The people who deny this are denying what's obvious. Are you going to try to tell me that human beings were born with an intention, a desire for the same sex? How does that happen? Just speaking naturalistically, you got a gene that dictates that you want, that you desire the same sex, let me promise you something. Your gene will not make it into the next generation. I mean, if you're sympathetic to Darwinism, this isn't going to happen. Obviously. Okay? It's not natural. Anyway, that's another discussion. it's just one of the things that makes this show so invigorating for me is to be able to not just only traffic in these great ideas, but to see how time and time and time again, the smart money is on the Christian worldview, obviously. And there may be a couple of exceptions, at least what appear to be exceptions initially, like the Trinity, but there's some other ways that the Trinity itself makes sense in light of other things. Pardon me, I've got a cold coming on. That's a scratchy throat. This is the last hour. Been jabbering for 2 hours now, and that just makes things a little sensitive. So if you hear me cough now and again, I'm just going to apologize. I don't have a cough button, so I'll try not to do it into the mic. And I'll refrain any further comments for interacting with you. We've got a bunch of folk on the line here, so let's just get right to it. And let's see. This looks like Hannah from Charleston, South Carolina. Is that right? Hannah?
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
We've been listening to you for a very long time, and we really appreciate your ministry. You do great things for God doing what you do.
Thank you.
So, we came up tonight. My husband and I were discussing this subject and realized neither of us really knew much about it, and we have a very good friend who's considering it.
A surrogacy, really, is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay.
She's a Christian, and so she's very concerned about making the right decision,
right?
You know, and making sure that God's okay with it, and it can be blessed, and it's something that can be she can do without any hesitation.
Right.
And so she wants plenty of, you know, reassurance from him, both scripturally and any other way she can get it. We're trying to help her out with that, but
all right,
we're a little dry, so I was hoping you could help us.
Yeah, let me ask, just for clarification's sake, you have a friend who is thinking about using the service of a surrogate, or somebody who is going to be a surrogate to give birth on behalf of someone else?
No, she wants to give birth on behalf of someone else.
Okay. First of all, this is a uniquely modern ethical question, because even though we had circumstances that were kind of like this in the Old Testament, where Sarah couldn't give birth, so she gave her handmaiden for Abraham to go into, which means straight up, it means that he had sex with her handmaiden.
Right.
So that she could have a child through that surrogate, that child wasn't hers. That child still belonged to the handmaiden. And actually, that whole situation created lots of problems. For one, you have a woman's husband having sex with another woman.
Right.
And it's sanitized because, well, she's going to have a child on my behalf, but it wasn't her baby anyway. So you can't really draw on these Old Testament examples as some kind of justification for doing that now. It's different. Now you have in vitro fertilization, so overt sexuality is not in view, presumably, and you have also the situation where the child that is born is given up from the birth mother and is given away to the contractual mom that's going to raise the child, the adoptive mom, if you will. So we have certain kinds of parallels in that there we do have adoption, and that seems to be morally acceptable. I don't know that there's any biblical passage that I am aware of that is going to directly speak to the circumstance, but I will tell you what one of my instructors in the philosopher over at Biola, Scott Ray, has said about this, and what Scott says to me, I think, is very significant. So this is going to be an argument that I'm going to offer you that is based more on a kind of natural law than it is by Scripture, because it is not clear to me that Scripture gives us anything specific that addresses it.
All right.
All right. So I'm trying to think of the best way to put this together. Let me see if I got this right. Your friend wants to get pregnant for the purpose of giving her baby away.
Yes.
Okay.
So her family, that she, I mean, they were both divorced, had their own kids. They kind of did a Brady Bunch thing,
yeah.
Came together. They have five kids now. Neither together, but they're content. Where
when
they're
you
at.
Say her and family, she, do you mean her own kind of her children? It's a blended family, or do you mean that she is a sibling of a blended family?
Oh no, I'm sorry. No, she's the mother. She brought children, and he brought children.
Okay, right. So okay, but she's had her own children, and
yes.
Now she wants to have a child with someone for someone else.
For someone else, yes.
And I presume this is going to be in vitro fertilization. So the father's genetic material will be the thing that contributes to the pregnancy of the baby she carries.
Right.
Okay. Now, I'm just going to say it again because I asked the question the way I did on purpose because I'm hoping that something will surface in the when you think about the way I put it. And the way I put it is precisely the way it is. Your friend wants to get pregnant for the purpose of giving her own child away. Now, I put it that way because, like I said, I think that is accurate, but it strikes me when you think about it that way as odd. Because what Scott Ray says is this woman will have to make a virtue out of a vice. Meaning that characteristically, normally, if you will, just normally, for a woman to purposefully disown her own offspring is considered a vice. To
yeah.
distance herself, to rid herself of her own offspring. And I do not care where the sperm comes from. It is irrelevant to this point. That baby is her baby, her egg, even if it wasn't her egg, it is her body that has produced this child for 9 months. And you know, I suspect, I don't know if you're a mother or not. Are you a mother?
Yes, I am.
You know what happens for a woman who produces a child in her womb. This baby is hers. And this is so powerful that in many cases, women who do have contractual obligations, like your friend is considering, renege on that obligation because they cannot countenance when push comes to shove, and it actually happens, departing from their own flesh and blood. They can't give their baby away to a stranger, nor should they, in my view. There is a powerful God-given bond that is made between the mother and the child she produces, and surrogacy requires her to deny that bond and give the child away. Now, is the child away, giving it away, can it be construed as a good thing? And yes, the answer is it's a great kindness. I don't deny that. But in order to do the kindness of giving the child away, the mother has to choose to distance herself forcibly from her own flesh and blood. And to do the good thing, she has to do a bad thing. She has to take the vice and call the vice a virtue. That is, the vice is being able to emotionally distance yourself from the child that way, and purposefully. See, this is in order to do a good for somebody else. When women who are single moms or maybe even married choose to give their children up for adoption, they choose to do so because keeping the baby would be a harm for the baby and the mother taken collectively. It is not good. The single mom, both of our children are adopted. So this is very close to my heart. Those mothers, at great sacrifice to themselves, those mothers surrendered their own flesh and blood into my wife and my care. because they deeply loved the child and thought that under the circumstances, this would be best for the child.
Right.
Because they got pregnant, and so under this crisis pregnancy situation, they surrender the child for the good of the child. The circumstance that your friend is talking about, she wants to engineer. She wants to engineer a crisis pregnancy.
And yeah, I think she's definitely, because she has such a big heart, and I think she's not considering the vice part of it. She's only seeing the
no,
hey,
of course.
This is how I could serve somebody.
Right, I know, but look at what. But it's look at the just because the end is noble does not mean that the means is noble. The end is to do something nice, but the means is to produce a child from her own loins and give the child away to be nice to somebody? You know, one of the difficulties, when you think about it, of adoption, what comes to mind, and we haven't crossed this bridge yet, with my daughters, but what would be a natural thing to come to mind one would expect as an adopted child grows to maturity and starts reflecting on his or her own origins? What question comes to mind? You tell me.
Who are my mother and father?
Who are? Okay, let's say they know that they're adopted. Okay, what's the next question?
Why was I given up?
Why was I given up? Why was I given up? You're absolutely right. Now, I just want you to think about this. I have actually never made this point before. It just occurred to me. But, oh, man, it's very powerful. So when the baby that is the result of a surrogacy asks why, let me back up for a minute. When my daughters ask, why did my mother give me up to you and mom? Papa, why did my mother, my birth mother, give me up? You know what I can say to them? Because she loved you. It is because she loved you so much that she was willing to go through the pain of releasing you to a family that could do a better job of raising her than you could, than she could. Okay? Raising you than she could. All right? You with me so far, right, Hannah?
I totally, yeah.
Okay, you know where I'm going now. So the child that is born of this surrogacy and gets adopted out, essentially, to another couple, this child is going to ask the same thing. And
sure.
What are the parents going to say when the child says, why did my mother give me up? Are they going to be able to say, because she loved you? Absolutely not. She cannot. They're going to say because she had a contractual arrangement. Because she loved us. Because she loved us.
Yeah.
That's why she gave up the baby? What is a child? I don't know. I'm just speculating how. But I know that I can stare my daughters in the face and say, your mothers loved you. Both your mothers loved you. You have no idea how much grief they went through to have to part with you because they wanted you. No one could ever say that to a surrogacy situation.
And you know, this kind of brings up another issue.
Just one line here, just hovering in the background, I've got to say. What they'd have to say essentially is, maybe they wouldn't use these words, but this is the fact of the matter. You were created to be given away. You were created by your mother to be given away to somebody else. Okay, there you have it. So what was it that you were going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, there's billboards all around our town right now asking for egg donors and pay $6,000 for each egg and whatnot, and every time I see it I feel weird inside. I never knew if that was just because I'm weird or if I my feelings that if I donate my egg somewhere and then they put that into another woman, that's still my child.
Okay.
And so
let me respond.
I would feel weird about
okay.
that.
Let me respond to that.
I just wonder if they were kind of in a parallel.
Well, I don't think they're parallel, because if they were, then you'd have to say is every time you menstruate, you lose a child.
Ah.
But you don't. The fact that you feel weird about it, you're welcome to that, and I understand that, but it's not the same, because an egg is not a human being. A sperm is not a human being. All right?
I hear you.
Every ejaculation would be millions of human beings that have perished if that's the case, and the same thing with each ovulation cycle. That in which there was no conception. No, I'm completely sympathetic to you feeling weird about that, and I don't think then you should ever give up any of your eggs for that purpose. I do think, though, that it's not morally questionable for others to do so, unless you accept a more Roman Catholic kind of natural law argument that no reproductive technologies are moral at all, period. Okay, and so that's a separate issue. I understand that, but personally, I don't buy into that, and I'm just going to say I don't think there's anything immoral about the egg. But giving up an egg, no problem. Giving up creating a human being for the sake of giving up that human being, I think you've got you probably figured out my own point of view here. I think it's unconscionable.
So as far as whether or not God would be supportive in it, that's kind of a hard thing.
It's the same thing. If I think it's wrong, it's because I think God thinks it's wrong, even though God has not weighed in on it explicitly in Scripture. So I could be mistaken on this. It's a judgment, but I've given you the reasons for my judgment, why I think it would be wrong. If it's wrong, it's immoral, and if it's immoral, then God. If it is immoral, if I'm correct in this view, then God thinks it's immoral too, you know, because all truth is God's truth. So I got to run from here. Hannah, thank you so much for your call. It really is a fascinating discussion, and I hope it's going to be helpful with you and your friend. Let's take a break here on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles, follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, church, or youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California, to equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to rethinkapologetics.com and register today.
All right, back with you here, Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel. And let me, since we have so many callers, I'm just going to go right to them. And here we have an anonymous caller. Hello, Anon. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
You must be the author of all those clever sayings that have your name at the end of them. Do you know what I mean?
Greg, you got to learn a new joke with that anonymous.
It's only the second time I've used it. All right. Okay, you got
I'm a
good
podcast listener.
Okay, so. Well, you okay? I am duly instructed here, so I repent in sackcloth and ashes. How can I help you, sir?
Well, Greg, I've been sitting on the phone trying to figure out how I'm going to parse this question. So maybe I'm just going to make it as simple as possible.
All right.
What would you, as a Christian, if your job, nothing about your job was necessarily immoral, but you understood that? The nature of your job was building pieces of technology that are going to be used for the mark of the beast.
Well, you've stipulated in this question that I actually know that's the case. And if I knew that was the case, I don't know that that would make my efforts immoral. Because first off, you stipulated that you know. If I actually knew it was being used as the mark of the beast, I still am not clear in my own mind that the behavior, would be immoral, okay? Because providing technology that is, it ends up being a piece of an end time scenario, I don't know that that makes it evil. Now, if this, if you said I knew I was building some technology that was going to be, I knew that it would be illicitly used directly to destroy innocent people, like maybe I'm building a torture device whose end only could have an immoral purpose, well, then that would be a little different. But this, it would not be clear to me in the scenario that you've given. Plus, you have stipulated that you knew it was for the mark of the beast. I don't know how anybody could possibly know that, because it requires people to know exactly what the mark of the beast is.
That's interesting that you say that. I occasionally have run-ins with people who I work with who are Christians, and and I have the type of stuff we work on is very high level. So it, when I run into them, I ask them, "Do you ever feel a little strange knowing what we're building?" And they say, I talked to a guy 2 weeks ago that said, "Yeah, my answer is, come Lord Jesus, and may this allow him to come sooner."
Well, again, it's hard to, the difficulty here is that, I mean, in part, knowing what the mark of the beast actually is, and that, and presuming that that's one problem. I mean, this is from the book of Revelations, chapter 13, and it's something that would be imprinted upon the hands or the forehead. I mean, just taking it as straightforward from the text, and this would allow people to buy and sell. And if you did not have the mark of the beast, then you couldn't buy and sell. You couldn't do commerce. And Christians are told not to take the mark of the beast. And so, therefore,
what about building it?
Yes, but I'm just laying this out because I don't see what if Christians are, what is immoral about the mark of the beast or building the mark of the beast? This is not clear to me. I can see how some people are going to use technology to then use it to distinguish. Well, Christians aren't going to take it because it would be an allegiance with a world order that itself is immoral, but the mark isn't. What if God said, look it, the new world order is going to require that people ride in cars, and the cars are going to make you complicit with things that are not, you know, with the order that I don't want. You should not ride in any cars that belong to the new world order. Well, that would make cars immoral. And building tires immoral, that would make participating in the new world order immoral, because that's what you're told not to do. That's why I'm faltering here. I don't think that the mark of the beast is itself immoral. I think it's the beast that's immoral and the use that it's being used.
All the pieces of it are the integration of everything is what I'm more talking about.
Well, okay.
The infrastructure is what we're working on.
So? I don't... Okay.
I shouldn't be bothered by what you're saying. I should not be affected by this.
Well, I'm just giving you my point of view. You have to follow your own conscience here. But I think that there are sometimes, and I became a Christian during the Jesus movement, and my first Bible study, the very first Bible study I ever walked into, and I was probably 3 weeks old in the Lord, Hal Lindsey was teaching it. All right? And I was a part of that community for 2.5 years. So, look, I'm sensitized to, like, second coming issues. I understand. I don't share that theology so much anymore. But the point is, I've thought about a lot of this stuff, and we thought we knew what the mark of what the beast was. The beast was a big computer that was in Brussels, and we had all these facts about the beast and everything. Well, that was 40 years ago, and I don't know what happened to that computer, but they called it the beast at the time, allegedly. Anyway, the point I'm making is I'm not sure that how to take a lot of that stuff in Revelation, and that's why for anybody to say that I know that I'm working into the mark of the beast – requires an insight into all of that stuff that I'm not sure anybody can say they have with certainty, okay? Secondly, even if you did and you were working on technology that someone was going to use illicitly, or you're helping to build an infrastructure that would turn around and be used by some kind of dictator to persecute Christians, I still am not convinced that participating in the infrastructure is itself immoral. I don't see the connection there personally. And I mean, if that were the case, then any government official who is involved in any kind of immoral government would be complicit with the immorality. And I don't think that the connection is there. Just like I said, I was trying to use the illustration about the cars. If you're building cars and then you knew that somewhere down the line, a person was going to say, if you don't get into my car, we're going to kill you, that somehow would mean that making the car is immoral. I don't think it's immoral. I think what's immoral is what the person is using this car for in that circumstance. I could be wrong on this, but I just don't see it.
I think I just needed some sound advice on what to think about it, because it's been kind of bothering me.
Yeah,
so.
Well, look, at again, Paul said, even if something is moral and your conscience, even in properly informed conscience, says it's immoral, you should follow your conscience. That's what Paul said. I mean, well, that's a paraphrase, of course, but he's talking about meat sacrificed to idols. But so follow, don't wound your conscience. But consciences ought to be, I think, accurately informed. And so I don't. This strikes me as a little bit of like 70s Jesus movement, late great planet Earth hysteria. I mean,
it might, unless you're working on it every day and you know what, you know, the psychology used to be able to make rational.
It's not that you're working on it every day. It's that what you're assuming it will be used to accomplish. And that entails a certain commitment.
That actually is pretty blatant, Greg. I have to say that most people.
So you have inside knowledge that the technology that you're working on is going to be used to control the world and exclude Christians to the point of being persecuted and killed.
That's not the theology. Christian part, but certainly the control the world part. I just know that there's certain aspects of this that are, the point of it is to be able to control people's behavior.
Yeah. Well, that's called psychology. It's also called marketing. It's also called, there's a lot of things that are, I'm just not going to climb on with that. You have to make your own decisions, but in terms of what I've seen so far and what you've told me so far, I don't think that you're, again, I can't, you know, I'm sure you're behind a black wall somewhere. You can't talk in more detail. So far from what I've heard, I'm not concerned. You might be thinking, I know more than he does, and there is concern, and my response is you're welcome to it. That's what you have to decide on ultimately. All right?
All right. Okay. Well, I appreciate it. I'm just going to just do the best I can every day, and I'll stop being so concerned with it, and I'll let God sort out the details.
Yeah. Well, look at the... whether or not it's the mark, Amy just put up a note. She said there might be ethical problems with it regardless of whether it's the mark or not. I don't know. But, you know, I've responded the best I could to the information that you've given me. So we'll just go with that. And thank you for the call, Mr. Anonymous. I'm sure we'll hear from some Anonymous again. I wonder if he's the same Anonymous that called last time. And that's why he didn't like my joke, because it was the same joke I used. I don't know. Let's looking at the clock. Okay. Quickly, let's go to Lucas from New Jersey. Lucas, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hello, Greg.
Hello there. Good. Okay. What's up?
So I'll jump right straight into the question. So my question is, well, let's give you some background first. So I had a friend. He was part of a theological cult. So I said theological, so it wouldn't...
implying, you know, sociological kind of coercion. Okay, got it.
All right. So he was part of this cult, and as I basically did apologetics with him, I noticed that he doesn't think so much for himself. Rather, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, but he's regurgitating the answers that his minister or pastor. Whatever.
Yeah, it was perfect diction, if that's the word you meant to use.
Okay. English is not my first language.
No, that's a pretty complicated word in English, if that's the case for you. So, plus, I can't even detect an accent, so you're doing fine.
Okay, good. I struggled with just many times. I would see that he doesn't study this stuff for himself so much. Rather, he just listens to his minister, and it seems like that's the norm in his cult, to just listen to the minister. And, and I studied some of their theology.
Is he still in the group?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I see. Okay, so. So your concern is he's not thinking for himself. He's just listening and regurgitates what he hears, and you want to get him to be more thoughtful about the things that are being offered him rather than just taking them at face value. Is that right?
Right. And also, I mean, I want to know, like, how to get anyone to think of that, because, I mean, I'm expecting I'll encounter people similar to that in the future. So it's not,
yeah.
I'm not looking
well,
for
I'll tell you what comes.
Case.
Right. I'll tell you.
Let me say one more thing. And then many times... his answer to when I quoted the Bible or said something, his answer was like, well, I don't know the answer about my minister, though. But then I never heard like a return from him. So
yeah,
it sounded like I didn't notice him being feeling compelled to actually look it up, even if looking it up was just asking his minister, which is fine. But
well, you know, if he says my minister does, I think it's fair to ask him, well, how do you know that your minister does if you don't know what the answer is?
Oh, he said it, but I don't remember.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's the answer.
Yeah,
he
you know.
Me.
Oh, well, okay. Here's just on that point. Maybe you can say, you know, I'd like to know what the answer to that is. Can you ask your minister and then tell me next time we get together? Because I'd like to know. I'm curious. Because I don't think this works in your system. I think it's a problem. Apparently, it isn't bothering you, but it's bothering me. So I'd like to know his answer to this question, and be sure you get not just the answer, but his reasons for the answer, okay?
Right.
And so that will force – ultimately, the way you get a person to think for himself is that – hold on just a minute. Can you hear that noise in the background? Are you making noise in the background?
Or is I'm sorry.
Okay.
I am so sorry.
Okay, thanks. Well, sometimes I think it's maybe our equipment, but it's a little bit distracting. Yeah, if you could just hold off for a second. Thank you. I think the best way to be able to get a person to think for themselves is to ask them the question, which is our second Columbo question, how did you come to that conclusion?
Right.
You want them to be able to articulate the reasons. And if they got the reasons from somebody else, at least they're in possession of the reasons that they think are convincing. If they don't know what the reasons are, then they are, you know, likely hitchhiking on somebody else's authority, and they haven't thought it through for themselves.
Right.
And the best way then maybe to get them to kind of pony up with something useful is to say, tell me what your pastor, whatever, has said to you about what the rationale is. And then that will force them to come back to you with some reasons. And I'll just close with this because I got to go to break. The number one way to get people to think for themselves is to ask them for the reasons or the rationale. And if they give you the reasons and it doesn't sound like those are very good ones, you can ask them, are you convinced by those things? That is the reason that you're convinced that this is the right way to go, and just see what they say. Some people, you can only lead them to water. You can't get them to drink, but Lucas, try that out, okay? Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to break and back for our final session in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market. and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All right, friends, final segment here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host, and here's Mark from New Jersey. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
Good, sir. Thank you. What's up?
My question is, if you could just comment on what do you think the motives of atheists are?
Mm-hmm.
Like these guys that write books or guys that do debates. Mm-hmm. I can understand a Christian or really any religious person. My motive as a Christian, I want to tell people about Christ. I want them to go to heaven. You know, I want them to live a moral life. But to me, I would think if I was an atheist, that would be the end of it. If somebody tried to tell me something, I said, you know, you're crazy.
Yeah.
See you later.
Well, I think
why are these people writing books and debating? What is their motive?
Well, this is a hard one to answer. I think you're on to something. In this sense, if atheism were true, that is,
right.
Ultimately, meaning can only be found in an individual's existential decision, and morality is a make-me-up, it's a trick of evolution, or it's a contract that we find convenient, though if we can get away with breaking the contract and not getting caught, well, better for us. I mean, if that's all that the world amounts to, and I think that's yet your basic materialistic atheist point of view, then
right.
then there is no transcendent value for people knowing that atheism is true, and there and what is the legitimate rationale for campaigning for atheism?
And right, that's what I'm curious.
Because there's no value in truth per se. It isn't like, well, we don't want people to be ignorant. Who cares if people are ignorant? There was no ultimate value.
Right.
So I don't know. I think, you know, it's really hard to read people's minds, but I do think I have asked myself the same question that you're asking, basically. If atheistic materialism is true, then what is the basis for even caring that much about anything like the truth of atheism versus some religious view? And they might say, well, religious people do harm to me. Well, really? What religious person is harming you? If there are some religious people who do harm, but it is the person who is. Do you lock your doors at night? Yes. Is it because there's so many religious people in your neighborhood? I doubt it. It's because there are people who are happy to do evil, you know, and make
right.
you the victim of it. So I don't think that religious people are harming atheists. They may be annoying atheists, but they're not harming them. We have more to fear regarding harm from people who have no deep moral abiding conviction grounded in religion rather than the opposite. Maybe Islam is an exception to that, but most people don't fear being hurt by Muslims either, not in this country. So that's not the problem, I don't think. Something else must be driving them. They could say, well, this is just the way I like it. I like being mad at, I think they're wrong, and being right or wrong doesn't ultimately matter, but it's just what I like. But I don't think they're going to want to say that either, because I think they're on a crusade. Pardon the use of the word there, but I think that they think they're accomplishing something good by campaigning for humanism and against any form of theism. But again, then the question becomes, what the heck do you mean by good? Do you mean objective good, or do you mean subjective good? If it's subjective good, then you're back to your selfish self-interest. If you mean objective good, how the heck are you going to ground that in an atheistic worldview? You can't do it in Darwinism doesn't give you objective good. It gives you subjective good only, relativistic good, if that. So I think that your challenge, your question is on point, though I just can't presume to get in the minds of your rank-and-file atheist that's making a commotion out there.
Yeah, I didn't know if by, having had debates with them or whatever, that you might have some insight, because to me it just doesn't seem to make sense why I would write a book about atheism, why I would spend time, arguing on the internet,
right,
or debating.
Right.
What is my motive? It seems like everything has some type of, end in mind.
Well, they do have an end in mind, and that end is to persuade people that atheism is true. But the question is, why would they pursue that end given atheism? And I think that's an entirely fair question.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know enough atheists to ask them, but the ones that I know were relatively passive atheists. That is, they're not out there campaigning. They are atheists, but they're not making a big fuss about it. But I think these other guys, and then you wonder. And I think it is fair to say sometimes ego is on the line and reputation is on the line and money is on the line. But I don't want to just stick them with those ignoble motives. I think that's likely in play, but I don't know what they would say actually drives them. So I don't know. Well, maybe somebody wants to call in sometime who's an atheist and they care about it, and they're going to tell you, here's why. Here's why we're motivated.
I would be curious to know. I understand what you're saying. I have friends who may question my Christianity, and I can have a private debate or a discussion, and they may give me their point of views as to why whether they're an atheist or agnostic.
Uh-huh.
But they're not writing books, or they're not debating.
Right, right. It's not a campaign for them. It's not a crusade. And And I think it's fair to ask that question. A lot of people may just have that conviction, but when you go on a crusade, something else is going on. And I don't get why, on the basis of atheism as a worldview, why such a campaign is actually that important, what justifies the campaign. And then I think it does then invite us to look a little deeper. Maybe there are some emotional motivations to making a big fuss about this, because I'll tell you one thing, I do not think for a moment that it has anything to do with rationality. It isn't like, well, I'm so committed to reason and rationality. Really? Then why is it that you believe in the multiverse, for which there's not a shred of evidence? Why do you believe that everything came from nothing, which is so ridiculously counterintuitive, that life came from non-life, that matter comes that consciousness comes from matter? There's no good reason to believe any of these things. So it is not reason. It is your commitment to a point of view that dictates that you believe these things. So the point of view came first, not reason.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't for a split second think that reason has anything to do with it, because they are on the wrong side of reason on so many times. And they are thick with irrationality, with informal fallacies, formal fallacies. They're thick with it. Not every single atheist, clearly. But the ones that are campaigning, we know they're thick with it because they're in print, for goodness sake. You can see it staring you in the face. And they're nasty characters, a lot of them. They don't want to debate. They want to ridicule. And ridicule's not an argument. Yeah, that's a classic ad hominem fallacy. So anyway, that couldn't be the reason. There may be other things going on. Maybe we'll hear from some atheists on that. Hey, thanks for the call, Mark, in New Jersey. Let's go to, I want to say, is it Melly or Mealy in Buffalo? Help me out here.
It's Melly.
Melly. Okay, Melly. Yeah. Glad to talk to you, Melly.
Well, Greg, it is a genuine pleasure just speaking with you. I've been a longtime podcast listener. This is the first time I've actually been able to catch you live and actually keep calling in.
Well, I'm glad to be able to end the show with you then. Thank you for calling, and thank you for listening.
Well, that is quite an honor. Well, I will make it quick, given that it's at the end of the show. I had a question or wanted your thoughts on a question regarding evil. In previous podcasts, one lady had asked you in regards to questions in terms of abortion and when the life of the baby as well as the mother is at stake, sometimes the lesser of two evils is to let the baby die. So when it comes to evil, there is such a thing as the lesser of two evils. But also, I believe I'm hearing you in terms of in countries that are ravaged with poverty and war and things of that nature, that kind of I don't even know if I call it evil person. Yeah, I would call it probably evil because you know some of it's persecution.
Uh-huh.
That the Bible actually thrives and it actually blossoms.
It does. By the way, I wouldn't call it the lesser of two evils. If I'm speaking strictly on a moral basis, I would call it the greater of two goods or the greater doing the greater good. Okay, so because if you it may seem like I'm splitting hairs, but there is a really an ethical nuance here. If when you are faced with a moral dilemma in which, in either case taken in isolation, it would be a bad thing, you have to let the greater, the more weighty moral obligation pertaining to these things guide you, so you accomplish the greater good rather than do the lesser of two evils. So it is good to protect life. If you got a mother's life and a child's life both in jeopardy, you do the good of taking the mother's, of saving the mother's life, even though it costs the child, rather than the allowing the harm of both lives being lost. So it's you're looking to do the greater good. Okay, that wasn't what you called about, but I just wanted to make that distinction.
I appreciate that. And so when it comes to the thing with the gospel where it blossoms, it seems that evil, God uses that evil for his own good.
Correct.
And so the question that came to mind, and I'm going to pose a question, then I also just have a request for just a recommendation.
About a study Bible.
From you.
Yeah.
Yes. And so, with the question of evil, is it even possible or feasible to, and I don't believe this is, but I want to just get your thoughts on it because I'm trying to figure out a rational way to work it. But is there even a concept of, okay, I use the term lesser of two evils, which I completely agree with your clarification, and then it looks like there's some evil, but God uses it for good.
Yeah.
And then thinking about free will, the choice of, in order for there to be real love, there should be, you need to have the, and as I understand it,
I'll just say it briefly, we have 2 minutes here, so I do not agree with that line of thinking, and another time I'll have to explain it. I do not think in order to have love, you have to have the possibility of evil, or else there would be no love in heaven. Okay, so just think about that.
Okay, yeah.
That's true.
Okay.
Was evil necessary? There is no necessity, just generally speaking, for evil. However, whenever you say something's necessary, you always have to think of what the end in view is. Why is it necessary? I get that pain in my arm right now. Well, it's because if I don't stick this needle in here, you won't get the medication that will heal your disease. So the end in view justifies the thing that's happening. If somebody's just poking me for fun, well, it's not necessary then. Was evil absolutely necessary? I don't think it was absolutely necessary. That means there could have been a universe in which there was no evil. However, if you are asking the question, could the greater good be accomplished, the greatest good, without the possibility of evil, then maybe the question is going to be no, evil was necessary for that thing. So you can't answer the question, was it necessary, unless you have this other teleology in mind, and that's only in the mind of God. And we can speculate on that, but only God ultimately knows. With 30 seconds left, let me tell you, I don't have a study Bible I use necessarily. Most study Bibles, and there are a lot of good ones out there, are theologically oriented. So like you can get the MacArthur Study Bible or the Ryrie Study Bible, and you've got some handy helps there. Those are both useful, and a lot of people I know have read the MacArthur Bible, John MacArthur, and I guess I could recommend that because I like the man, but that doesn't mean it's the best study Bible out there. There's also the Net Bible, N-E-T, the Net Bible. You can get it on the net, but it's also you can also get it, the volume. It was given to me by the people who publish it. I love that because there's so many study helps that are in there. There's so much commentary about individual verses. So that helps me too.
Okay.
But whenever I say, yeah, the Net Bible or the MacArthur Study Bible, then it sounds like I'm saying that's the best one to the exclusion of others, and I just can't say that. I think anybody who has done a study Bible, whose contributors you recognize and you respect, is going to be a respectable study Bible. I don't agree with everything that John MacArthur says or writes, so there are going to be things I don't agree with even in that one. But the Net Bible I have liked because there just seems to be a lot of information about different passages that is helpful and useful, and but those are that's the only one I've ever spent much time with. So I'm just not a fan of study Bibles. So that's the best I can do. Melly, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate the question and hope that helps. That's it, friends. What a day. If you didn't catch the whole show, you ought to have. Be sure and you sign up for the podcast because lots of good things today. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, all right, friends? All week long. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.